Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. I recently had the opportunity to chat with Nancy Lee Wood, who's a professor at Bristol Community College here in Massachusetts. We originally began our discussion talking about methods for drawing down, that is to say, removing carbon from the atmosphere, primarily through the use of trees and reforestation. But as these things go, our discussion became more broad and philosophical. I'm including it all here. The show's a little bit longer than usual, but I think you'll find it interesting. Happy to have had the opportunity to catch up with Nancy Lee Wood, who's a faculty member here at Bristol Community College, in sociologist by training, right?
Right.
And you've been working on sustainability issues for a long time, for years now, right? And I guess we've just been chatting, but I mean, tell me, there is a concept of biosustainability. Mm-hmm. I think is the correct word, which basically I think envisions utilizing natural processes to capture carbon back into the soil.
Right.
Is tell me more about that.
Right. Well, if we could just back up for a moment, because I think it's important for people to understand that 99.9% of the discussion about dealing with climate change and how to handle it has focused on reducing emissions.
Mm-hmm.
So that means developing things like wind, solar energy, driving Priuses, for instance, putting solar panels on your house. I mean, all of these things are ways of reducing the amount of carbon that goes into the atmosphere. So there's been almost all of the discussion has been focused on reducing the emissions, but there hasn't been the focus on drawdown. So if we were to magically
drawdown, specifically meaning drawing down the level of carbon from the atmosphere that's already floating around up in the clouds.
That's right. There's something called the Keeling curve, and the Keeling curve is focuses on the fact that every winter we see the carbon emissions going up a little bit, and in the summertime we see the carbon emissions going down. And they're going down in the summertime because the deciduous trees have their leaves and they're doing photosynthesis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so if we had a normal pattern, it would go up, down, up, down, up, down, but it would be a level up, down. But what we see with the Keeling curve is there's an up-down-up-down motion, but there's a curve upward to increased emissions taking place in the atmosphere.
It's riding on a level. There's no variation. Yeah.
That's right. So we're emitting approximately 130 billion tons of carbon dioxide
mm-hmm.
annually,
mm-hmm.
and we're drawing down 120 billion tons of carbon dioxide annually, which means 10 billion tons are remaining in the atmosphere.
So 10 billion tons. And when you say we, you mean the Earth.
Humankind.
And how is that being drawn down?
It's not. That is the global warming effect.
But there's 130 total. There's
130 and 120 coming down.
120 being pulled in.
But there's 10 that's remaining in the atmosphere. And this has been going on for about 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 600 billion tons of excess carbon dioxide. If we had kept it normal, up and down, up and down, up and down, and kept it a level up and down, then we would see that we'd have as much being drawn down as has been emitted. But what's happening now, we are emitting more than we are drawing down.
And the natural processes that draw the carbon out of the atmosphere are absorption in the ocean and things like that, right?
Yes.
Right. So that's when we say we, it means the oceans are doing it, not humans.
That's right. The drawdown is happening through natural processes.
Right.
So we have, you know, one of the biggest benefits to us are trees. And we've lost over 3 trillion trees.
With a
on
T.
the planet. With a T, a big capital T. We've lost 3 trillion trees since the beginning of the agriculture period. We're talking about 10,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's been some up and down and up and down again with the number of trees and lowering. But we're functioning with only about half the amount of trees that we started out with when we as a species began to move around the planet. Mm-hmm. And we've not only done a lot of deforestation, but we also have been building cities and just paving over soil, blacktop, cement, buildings, and so forth, parking lots and so forth, which means that soil is really has become degraded, and the life in that soil is not being activated, which can use that carbon that when it's drawn down through plant life, not just trees, but plant life in general, it goes into the soil and benefits the soil, benefits all those critters in
little
the soil.
Little tiny critter, some of the magic here is tied up in the little critters you can't see, microcell organisms that are in the soil that thrive, right?
So, you know, while we have been paving over a great deal of the earth, we also have been cutting down deforestation, and through the kinds of agriculture, especially industrial agriculture, we have been neutering what soil there is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you're talking about pesticides and so forth and herbicides, what you're really talking about is killing a lot of this natural life that, in fact, could be very useful in the whole process of drawdown.
Is it, for example, is the Great Depression scenes of the Dust Bowl, that was, I think, akin to what you're saying, right? The soil was degraded and then it just all kind of blew away because, again, the structure of the critters in the soil weren't there to keep it rich and in place, right?
Yeah, that's right. And when you're using all of this machinery, mm-hmm. What you're really doing is disrupting that very vital top layer of vitality in the soil. Mm-hmm. You know, so we teach at the college, we have a program in agriculture, and we teach no-till agriculture, which means you're not going to do plowing. You're not going to do a lot of digging up. It's horrible for soil. It should not be done. All of these machines that you see, they should be, you know, taken to a scrapyard.
On the Sunday morning TV shows where ConAgra shows you the big thing going across the plains, digging up, that's bad news.
That's bad news. Okay. It's really bad news. Because what you're doing is you're disrupting the topsoil, which has so much of the nutrients and so forth that plant life needs, and that the critters are involved in maintaining, right?
And it suggests that the there's some sort of structural, I mean, once you break it up, then the critters can't, and we're using a funny word, right? The critters in the soil, but I mean, once you break up the soil, all of a sudden they're exposed to sunlight and air, and they start to die and things like that.
And also what you're doing is releasing carbon into the atmosphere, okay? So industrial agriculture contributes also to carbon emissions, right? And then when you have all these pesticides and herbicides that you're using, what you're really doing is killing a great deal of life in the soil itself. Yes, you can keep maybe a something alive, but you're killing all of the rest of what's happening in the soil. You're killing the biodiversity of the soil. And so it becomes really critical to transform our agricultural system. So through deforestation, through industrial agriculture, which we've been desertifying a lot of our land now, neutering a lot of our land, through the paving and urbanization and so forth, making space for the 7.7 billion people on the planet, soon to be 9.5 billion by the middle of the century, right? We have destroyed so much of the vitality on the planet. And as a result, you know, we've gotten away with it for a while. We've gotten away with it for quite a long while, but we're not getting away with it any longer, because that's what's contributing to the whole issue of climate change and weather pattern changes and so forth. So what we need to be doing is to be drawing down this carbon into the soil through deep-rooted plant life, okay?
And deep-rooted plant life, what does that mean?
Deep-rooted plant life means the lawn, the normal lawn that you see, just isn't going to do it.
Okay.
You really need to have deep-rooted plant life, you know. So I'll give you an example. In my yard, I have a very small urban plot that my house is on. But I took a big space of that plot, and last year, in fact, I hired a couple of the students here in the agriculture program to come and plant hostas in my yard, okay? Because I don't know if you've ever tried to pull hostas up after they've taken root for 2 or 3 years, but you have one dickens of a time.
Because their roots are, they spread,
because
and their roots
they,
are
they
deep.
They go way down and they go way spread. That's exactly the kind of root system you want, because that's what promotes all of the vitality of the different critters.
Mm-hmm.
It also promotes the canal space for waters, for water retention. So you keep water in the ground a lot longer, which means if you have water in the ground during dry periods, things are not going to all shrivel up and die. That these are the kinds of things that we need to be doing. And we, you know, we keep talking about, you know, some kind of technological fix, that we, you know, we'll come upon a technological fix to take care of all of this. Well, nature has been doing this for many, many centuries, and we don't need the technological fix. What we need to do is to allow nature to do what it can do, which means we need to have, we need to do some serious reforestation. And I'm not talking about plantations. I'm talking about reforestation in rural areas and in urban areas. Okay, we need to be doing not the industrial agriculture, but we need to have smaller farms, permaculture-based farms.
This is basically organic, correct me if I'm wrong, but organic farming
organic,
constitutes much of this, right?
Yes, organic farming, because you're going to allow for all those critters to live, okay? And, you know, there's a wonderful film that came out. I don't know if you saw it recently or not, but it's really worth seeing. It's called The Biggest Little Farm. And it was The Biggest Little Farm. And it's just remarkable what these people have done with this farm. But the key, one of the key things that comes out of it is that they kept having one more biological crisis that they were trying to deal with. And I mean, one that's very clear in my mind is suddenly they had this infestation of snails. And they thought, you know, oh God, the snails are just eating up everything. You know, here goes our farm, you know. And then, but, you know, nature has a way of taking care of its own. Pretty soon, they began realizing that the ducks were interested in the snails. And the ducks took care of all the snails, right? And they were quite happy, right? They had happened to have some ducks. They had a lot of different animals, including
ducks. Now they have very fat ducks.
But, you know, if you have a pest, there is a critter that's going to be interested in that pest. That's not interested in eating up your farm, right? But interested in eating up the pests. You know, so, I mean, we have removed ourselves so far from nature. You know, like our great-grandparents knew about these things. You know, they could tell us all of this stuff, right? But, you know, being the smart beings, I put that in quotes, that we are, we moved away from all of that and have lost a great deal of that knowledge. So the ordinary person has no idea how to deal with these issues today.
So I'm dying to ask the question. The sociological implications of how is it, what has to change in order for people to move back to the kind of connection to the, to, I mean, it's, you know, you say connection to the land. I mean, they're sort of high-flying
right.
phrases, right? They don't really mean a lot, right?
Right?
But how do you change society so that people accept and live with, not you to internalize the need for the kind of thing that I think you're calling for? Right?
Yeah.
I mean, have you thought much about that?
Well, I mean, my immediate response to that is that there are so many ecological issues taking place today that are threatening our existence, never mind some other species' existence, that's threatening our own existence, that we have to begin to realize that we are part of nature and we need to re-enter the space of nature. You know, we have, you know, here's the earth and here's nature, and then we've moved ourselves outside. You know, so we keep doing things, you know, that control nature, right? And we're seeing right now that nature has a lot more control than we do. You look at the fires in California, you look at the floods and tornadoes taking place in the Midwest, you look at the cyclones that recently happened in Mozambique. I mean, I can go on and on and on and on, right? I mean, this is what's happening. And we have to come, hopefully these things are happening in such a way that it's making us realize we have to figure out some way of re-entering the space of nature so that we can cooperate with nature instead of trying to control nature.
Re-entering, I mean, just capturing that, re-entering
the space of nature.
The space of nature.
Right.
Which, so, I mean, you, re-entering the space of nature. I guess, how does that compete, or how do you think that competes in the human psyche with all the other stuff? I mean, I guess that's at some level, for climate, to address climate change at a very large scale, it's almost like there needs to be this great awakening, almost. I avoid the word religious, but this sort of spiritual sensibility about what we're doing, right? And that if you focus on kind of a technical fix, you're always in a technical fix, and you miss the bigger picture, kind of thing you're talking about.
Because you're staying in the space of humans, not in the space of nature.
Right.
When you're thinking about the technical fix, that's what you're looking at. You're thinking, oh, I'm over here and I can take care of it, and I can make nature do what I want it to do. Well, nature's not doing what we want it to do. We don't want to have these fires. We don't want to have these floods. We don't want to have these tornadoes. We don't want to, we don't want to, we don't want to. And guess what we have? We have all of those things. Yeah. And it's because we have not been watching, conscious, involved in nature, in understanding how nature operates and how we are part of all of that operation.
Do you think that's a particularly Western, you know, affluent Western issue? Or do you think it's all mankind? I mean, I guess I think it's not necessarily all mankind, but certainly here in America, Europe, I mean, that distance from the connection to the, shall we say, the real, in quotation mark, world.
Yeah.
You think that's the case, or do you think it's something else?
This is a huge question.
there's a lot of space for that record.
Huge question. Well, I mean, you know, I have a colleague at Biodiversity for a Livable Climate, mm-hmm. this organization in Cambridge, who would say, well, it really begins with agriculture. We're talking about 10,000 years ago with agriculture, when we started digging up the soil. And, of course, we weren't understanding a lot of the processes of soil and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. And that we've gone on and on and on. And then we see this real fast-forwarding of ecological destruction beginning to take place with the Industrial Revolution. And that's when we have the use of fossil fuels that are relatively cheap. They're extremely powerful in terms of their energy components. All, you know, everything that we do today is really dependent upon fossil fuels. And that has taken us outside. You know, those are natural things, but we've been using them in ways that are controlling, trying to control the rest of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to, you know, understand that we have to move beyond that period of time. It was a very useful period of time. We learned a lot. We gained a lot of technology and so forth. But we're at a point now where it's not something that's benefiting us. Is something that is destroying us, destroying the planet. And we have to move outside of that thinking.
Almost but as a species, you would say.
As a species.
I don't disagree. I mean, I think it's this conception you know, what we are as, you know.
Right. But, you know, I mean, like, you know, I'll tell my, you know, for instance, I'll say to my students, you know, if you want to have a baby and you're pregnant, don't plan on that baby being ready at 3 months. That's not nature's plan. Nature's plan for you as a species having a baby is 9 months, right? And then you're going to have a full-term healthy baby, right? You can't rush it along. You can't push it along. You can't technologize it along, you know? This is a natural process. And the same thing, you know, I was talking with someone this morning, he says, if you want watermelons here in Massachusetts in December, you're not going to get them, because we don't grow watermelons in December. If you want pumpkins and squash, you'll find them in December.
Right.
you know. But you're not going to find them in May here.
Right?
You know, there's a whole natural process that, with everything, that we have moved ourselves so far away from. You know, we go to the supermarket and we expect everything to be there. You know, things that don't even grow around here, like pineapples, you know, and oranges and so forth, right? And that's not to say that we shouldn't have pineapples and oranges. You know what I mean? We've seen this as being normality, when in fact it's abnormality. How we live today is abnormal.
So do you think, I mean, so it's, I did not expect the conversation to go in this direction. Do you think that the human species would learn through the punishment of climate change? Or do you think there's hope that, again, you're speaking in very large terms, right? The species can somehow shake itself out of the trance it's in and take a better path? Or is it going, you might, I mean, I read some book about how humans have always procreated their way out of a crisis, right? Mm-hmm. If there's a big collapse, then once the, you know, 1,000 years from now, the humans will still be trying to dig up fossil fuels again, right? They won't have learned anything.
Right.
What, do you think that it is only through adversity that the species changes? That's a big question.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what actually is happening. I think that's actually what's happening. Although it's not to say that some of the people who are doing some of the most critical work are the ones who are feeling the strongest pinch from climate change. You know, I think of this young woman from Sweden, Greta Thunberg, right? You know, she's had the wisdom at a very, very young age to recognize that her generation and future generations are in big trouble. And she hasn't felt the pinch directly, you know. I mean, she wasn't in Mozambique when the cyclones hit, you know, in March.
Not in Chennai, Chennai, India, with no water
this week. Right, you know. But, you know, the other thing that I was actually having a conversation with a group of Buddhists the other day regarding this. And it's, I think that, If you to ask most people, this is my take on it. If you ask most people if everything is okay, they're going to say no. People have a real sense that there's something that's really off, you know, on a lot of levels, whether you're talking about the political or the social or the cultural or the climatic, etc., etc. The things are really kind of off. They may not be able to articulate what it is. And even if they were articulate about it, they're not quite sure exactly what it is. But people have this real sense of there's a disruption going on, and they don't know how to think about it, how to handle it, how to deal with it, what it means really for them, what it means for the future, and so forth. And I think that that precariousness is a really good position for our species to be in, because it means, well, it can mean one of two things, one good and one bad. The one, I'll start with the good one, okay?
Okay.
The good one is that we can really start listening and paying attention to what's going on around us and begin asking the serious questions that everyone should be thinking about. How am I going to get my food? Where is clean water going to come from? Am I living on property that could be damaged by sea level rise? Is the local water source that I drink from going to be affected by sea level rise salinating that water? I mean, these are all issues. And we don't have a political system, we don't have a media system, we don't have a business system in this country which are encouraging people to ask those questions. Right? And so if they ask those questions, it's because they've either had some direct experience or they've taken a course, or like you, you know, they had a couple of experiences and, you know, the flashpoint came.
The light went on.
Right, the light went on. You know, but that sense of precariousness, I think, really encourages people to wake up and to try to find answers to some really, really difficult issues that everyone on the planet, I don't care how old you are, how young you are, how white you are, how black you are, how rich you are, how poor you are. I don't care what you are. Everyone is going to be impacted by these issues. And everyone has a responsibility. The good thing also, I think, is that this is the one thing that can unite us across the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Because we share the planet. And things that is happening in one part of the world has an impact in another part of the world. And we have to figure out how to make all of this work so that we're all okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The bad part is, okay, the second part is, that precariousness can lead people to look for very quick and easy answers by very demonic characters who promise the world and have nothing but unfortunate circumstances to deliver. Right.
The simplified picture that the is easy to grasp and dissolves the precariousness.
Yeah, exactly. And that has, and that can become extremely authoritarian. Right. And given the nature, I'm using quotes here, nature of people to want to find someone who is a kind of father figure, who will take care of me, who will come up with all of the answers, becomes very dangerous in circumstances where people are feeling precarious because, oh, they have the answer. They'll, you know, they're going to take us out of this mess that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, they may be, and likely are, increasing the complexity and the mess.
No, I agree that the risk to democracy and the human spirit is great. Not
right.
just here in the United States right now, but I mean
right.
over the next centuries,
right?
Right, there's going to be real, because there will
right.
be big issues, and the easy way out is some sort of
right.
Less respect for the individual, which
right.
is a scary
right.
prospect. Right?
But you raised an issue that I've not spoken of, but I think it's a really important point, and that is that, first of all, I'm not a religious person at all, okay? I don't have a religious bone in my body. I don't follow any religion and so forth. But I feel very spiritual, and I feel very connected to nature. I've never thought of myself as, for instance, a tree hugger or a big environmentalist and so forth, but I feel a great sense of connectedness with the beauty of nature. I know I feel calmer when there's trees and flowers and birds and so forth around. I appreciate what this beautiful earth has to offer us. And I think that that's a kind of spirituality that people are desperate to be looking for as well. You know, we have so many, well, there's a lot of organized religion, and I think there's a lot of kind of pseudo or semi-religions. And it's really easy for people to fall into those because they, too, come up with easy answers, right? When, in fact, you know, if you look at Native American populations, from the past, you know, long before we came in,
mm-hmm.
disrupted their ways of life, they understood that nature, that their god, if you will, or their goddess, was nature.
Mm-hmm.
That they had to protect nature. That they lived their lives for the seventh generation, which meant they were living their lives for people who that they would never know or never see,
mm-hmm.
never speak with, but they were living their lives for those people. And they lived their lives through paying attention to nature, protecting nature where they could, understanding nature, and they were part of nature.
Right. They saw themselves, and I mean, I've often, I agree with you in many respects. I do not consider myself highly religious, but when you, but I read about it, and it seemed, you know, there is a prejudice in favor of current religious structures and an assignment of primitive to people
mm-hmm.
that to societies that followed the moon, understood the positions of
right.
the sun. I mean, we're coming up right now on the summer solstice, the longest day of the year, which is a profound, you start thinking about it, that's
right.
a profoundly spiritual moving
right.
idea,
mm-hmm.
right? And to dismiss that as somehow primitive
mm-hmm.
Is an arrogance that I think
yeah.
the human race doesn't have anymore.
Yeah.
Right? We need to it's important to incorporate this. I mean, it's tough to fight City Hall, right? So you're not going to change people's opinions about religion, but incorporating
right.
An Earth-centric view
yeah.
is really important.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah. And, you know, when you think about this, I was having another conversation recently with someone in Taunton. I live in Taunton. And there's an interest in getting school gardens going in Taunton. And we were talking the other day about, you know, how children simply don't play outside any longer. You know, which is really different from my generation, our generation, where, you know, parents said, go outside. Go get a friend, go play outside, you know.
Come back at dinner time.
Yeah, come back at dinner time, you know. And, you know, and I can remember when I was just a little kid, you know, making hundreds and hundreds of mud pies and decorating them with rocks and worms and, you know, snails, anything I could find, you know.
I remember watching my younger brother put ants on sticks and then floating the sticks across the pond. Right.
But, you know, I mean, and that's, you know, that was just a simple thing, just playing in the dirt. And it was okay to get dirty, you know. I mean, that's what water is for, you know. You get washed up, right?
Right.
You know, and, you know, I can remember, you know, my parents weren't big gardeners, but there was always a little flower bed and there was always a little vegetable bed, you know, and we puttered around in it, and we were puttering, we weren't depending on that garden for our sustenance. But it was something that my mother especially had grown up on a farm as a child, so she wanted to have some tomatoes and peppers and so forth, you know, in the garden. And, you know, there's just an awareness. And, you know, I can remember as a kid, we had this great big elm tree, huge elm tree on our property. And I'm living in the same house that I grew up in.
Oh, really? Oh.
So there was this big, big elm tree. And I can remember whole summers of being under that elm tree. I don't even remember anything else about the summer. But that's where I played, you know. And when I got, you know, bigger and I wasn't playing with dolls and house and doing all that, I'd sat under there and read, you know. And then I can remember, you know, unfortunately that elm tree caught Dutch elm disease, as so many did in this area, and died. And I can remember, you know, when the tree was cut down, I mean, I cried and cried and cried, you know. And I never thought of myself as being a big lover of trees or a big, you know, tree hugger. I mean, I never thought of myself as a big environmentalist, you know. But I had a connection with that tree, and I loved that tree. And that tree was a very important part of my life when I was growing up, you know. And now that tree had died, and it was being cut down. I mean, even now.
I've made the case many times that the connection to, there is a connection to why climate matters. And I think that, I mean, we started this conversation about the need for deep-rooted plants and trees, and now you're saying that as a child, there was an elm tree that you found great sustenance in it.
Right.
It seems like that is a flashing connection is, you know, why, and I think it behooves people listening to the podcast to say, you know, why do I care about this? Because that is this motivating source of energy in tough times as to why you care, right?
And what worries me very much at this point is that children today don't have those kinds of experiences. Many children don't. They don't play outside. They don't connect with a tree. They don't connect with the worms. They don't chase a bug around.
Because your mother doesn't want them to get Lyme disease. Right?
Yeah. I mean, they don't, you know, they're not out in nature. And there's a wonderful writer by the name of Richard Lauv. I'm not sure if you know him or not, but he talks about nature deficit disorder as being a health issue where children no longer are out doing things in nature, having fun in nature, but instead they're sitting on the couch with the technology and so forth. And his point is, you're not going to learn to love and to protect something that you haven't had exposure to early in life. And if you don't love something early in life, you're not going to be so inclined to take care of it and protect it later. You know, and in some ways, I hope he's wrong. I hope that, you know, you can be a 20-year-old or a 25-year-old and discover trees and so forth.
I mean, the advice is to take a hike and go make some connection to where you are.
Right.
Well, let me ask a different question. To come back to the question of the deep-rooted plants, you talked about a little garden plot. Would you advise people to plant, I guess, the equivalent of a victory garden. So everyone knows World War II victory garden kind of thing. Is that a path that people can take if they want to do something? I mean, someone listening to this podcast, they say, you know, you're right. What can I do? Aside from changing, you know, calling your congressman and demanding the Green New Deal, want to do something up close and personal. What is it?
And everybody can do something right in their household, right in their neighborhood, right in their city or town. So people can do, they can take, pull up that grass, you know, or don't pull it up, you know, start, learn about how you prepare your land in the fall for a garden for next year, okay? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we don't need to have a lot of grass. People can be growing vegetables. You know, I have a friend who had never grown anything, and she was terrified, you know, and she said, I don't know where to begin. I said, get yourself one tomato.
Get a shovel.
No, get yourself one tomato plant and put it in a pot, and that's your goal this summer. Right. You get one tomato plant, and I said, you have to nurture it. You put it in the sun. You have to give it some water. But pretty soon it's going to do all of its thing, and there's going to be tomatoes, and you're going to see that you've been very successful as a gardener. Well, now she has a whole garden.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, people think, you know, I mean, nature is very forgiving, you know.
Yeah.
You can really mess up a lot, you know, and still nature will come through for you, you know.
So tell me, here, let's go back to a political question. I mean, the scale of things, I'm sure you've heard the phrase, we need system change, not climate change. Right, and whether or not individual actions matter. Right? Mm-hmm. I would submit that individual actions do matter, but in and of themselves, but also as setting the political groundwork for bigger collective changes. Mm-hmm. Is that something you would buy into, or would you make the case that if everyone took it upon themselves in their own backyard to do the right thing, that that would be sufficient?
It would be a big move forward. And what I would like to say is I don't see this either climate change or systemic change. The systemic change has to be within climate change. That's what we have to do. We have to re-enter the space of nature.
Mm-hmm.
We have to create systems that are within the space of nature so that our human activities coincide with how nature operates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to go back to the earlier question because, you know, people think, well, I don't even have space for a garden. Well, if you have a little patio, okay, if you have a little window box, you can grow some herbs and so forth. You can support your local farmer. Okay, that's a really important thing to do.
Find a farmer's market, basically.
Find a farmer's market. There's also these things called CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture, where you pay money up front before the season starts, and that gives the farmer some money for his or her inputs and so forth. And then as nature produces, you know, you're not going to get watermelons in May. You know, you're going to have to wait till July and August, right? And you're not going to get pumpkins in May. You're going to have to wait till September and October. But you go to the farm, to the
CSA. But what you do
CSA,
get is absolutely fresh.
You get absolutely fresh and usually, especially around this area, organic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Organic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's delicious. You're supporting your local farmer. And households can do that, but we also should be having, you know, asking, you know, why aren't hospitals using that food? What about the local prisons? What about the local schools? What about the local nursing homes?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
They all should be supporting local farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be supporting the local farmers in order for the farms to stay in business, because I'm here to tell you, those are the people who are going to be the local heroes in the future. We cannot be planning on lettuces coming from California or oranges coming up from Florida all the time. We're going to see some real changes in where food is coming from, and we need to be supporting the local farmers who are quite capable of supplying us with food, but they can't keep operating if we don't buy from them, right?
I mean, what you're saying is in the future where things are more disrupted,
yes,
you're going to be looking to the to your local farmer down the street to help
right.
you eat.
Right.
And so it's a good time now to start befriending that farmer,
right.
making sure it's a robust system.
That's right. The time to be supporting your farmer is not when your pantry is bare and you're holding a seed and saying, I wonder what I'd do with this. The time to be supporting local farmers is now, so that all of that infrastructure is in place at a time that's going to come down the road that's going to be very, very challenging in terms of food security. But I want to go to one other thing.
Okay? Great, go right ahead.
All right? We also need to have forests in cities. We need to have long-living trees, not trees that are grown to be cut down, but trees that are going to grow and grow and grow and be around for several centuries, because they are the ones with a great, big, long, deep root, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We cannot be cutting these down. And cities can have forests. You know, I was in the city of Karlsruhe in Germany a few years ago for a conference, and they have a couple of forests in the middle of the city. Green, lush, wild forest growing, you know. And there's some little trails where people can go for their hiking and so on. But right in the middle of the city. That's what we need to have, mm-hmm. right? You know, so those are two major things. We all can do some little agriculture. You know, have a little herb garden. You could have it even in your window. You can even have it, you know, if you have a sunny area inside, you can even be growing some little plants and so forth inside, right?
I mean, it's interesting that this sort of this interplay of both the actual carbon sequestration, so to say, in the soil, but at the same time, the kind of spiritual dimension of reconnecting.
Right.
Right? They both come into play right. in the kinds of right. things that you're right. talking about.
That's right. If you live in a city where the schools don't have school gardens, why don't they? There's nothing wrong with kids getting dirty. There's nothing wrong with kids getting a scratch on their knee. This is what kids do, okay? right? you know? Kids should be out doing work, you know, having some sense of how do you grow things. You know, it's really, there's been a couple of things that I want to talk about. One is a couple of studies that came out where very young children, like 5, 6, 7 years old, couldn't identify vegetables. I mean, some basic vegetables. Like, they didn't really know what a tomato was. They knew tomatoes were in ketchup, but they couldn't identify a tomato. Right?
I'm thinking of a cartoon I saw where the kids get off the school bus and there's a couple of milk bottles thrown away on there, and they say, oh, look, it's a cow's nest.
You know, so kids, I mean, the other thing is that, you know, kids are, oh, I don't like zucchini, oh, I don't like tomatoes, oh, I don't like carrots and so forth. But when they start growing them,
they're in love. They love them. I mean, they grow them.
This becomes very interesting.
Yeah.
Look at that. Look at that. I just put the seed in, and look, it's germinating, and I water, and the sun is out, and it's growing, and it's getting bigger and bigger, and pretty soon there's the stuff that I eat, and all of a sudden those things become very tasty.
I think that you're, I'm sure consciously, but I mean certainly, pointing out there's a bunch of different benefits of the regreening process that you're arguing for, right?
Yeah.
It's good for the family, it's good for the child,
right.
It's a learning experience, it's good
right.
for your soul, it's good for the planet,
right.
It's all
right.
good all the way around. Huh?
Oh, and by the way, we may be able to survive if we take that route.
Oh, there you go.
That's an added benefit.
Well, look, this has been a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat. We've covered a lot of ground, different than anything I'd anticipated,
right.
but I think that your ideas are certainly, in addition, food for the soul and food for thought and food for your stomach.
Well, thank you. And if I may do an unabashedly promotion.
Absolutely. Shameless self-promotion.
Self-promotion.
Always welcome here.
Okay, we have a sustainable agriculture program at Bristol Community College.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a degree or a certificate in sustainable agriculture. So that's one program.
That's great.
And we have a sustainability studies program, which is a new program. I'm the coordinator of that program,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
and you can get a degree in that as well as a certificate. And this focuses on particularly helping people to understand the critical issues that we have facing us and exploring the kinds of things that we need to do to get out of the mess we've gotten ourselves into. Okay. And then one third thing, there's a wonderful organization in Cambridge, Biodiversity for a Livable Climate. And I'm
is that the website? What is it?
It's bio4climate.org, the number four.
Okay.
So bio4climate.org.
Okay.
And it's in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's a relatively young organization, about 6-7 years old. We've done about 12 conferences. One of them is here.
Uh-huh.
Most of them international conferences.
Interesting.
And we've had speakers from all over the world come talk about the issues of deep-rooted growth, of grassland restoration, tree restoration, and so forth. And we have a compendium, lots of data, lots of information in that, as well as all of the sessions that we've had in all of those conferences have been videotaped.
Okay.
So if you're interested in knowing more about this topic, there's lots of information out there, and you can find it through bio4climate.org.
Bio number four climate.org.
Right.
And Bristol Community College is bristolcc.edu if you want to look at it again.
Right.
Well, again, I want to thank you very much. It's been very entertaining.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation. That's been fun.
So there you go. You can check out the links to some of the stuff we discussed at the blog. It's massclimateaction.org/blog. Of course, you can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction and listen to us on most of the podcast distribution apps you can find on your computer. Send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net and let us know what you'd like us to talk about. We'll close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and we recognize our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we must insist the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So thanks for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.